From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk about love, writing, and collecting with Susan Sontag. Her new novel, The Volcano Lover, A Romance, is a bestseller. Also, how the merging of lobbying and public relations has affected American politics. We talk with investigative journalist Susan Trento. Her new book, The Powerhouse, is about influence peddling. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new CDs of Beethoven sonatas performed by Andrew Rangel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today urged his domestic advisors, as well as home builders, insurance executives, and volunteer organizations to redouble their disaster relief effort in Florida and Louisiana. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush canceled a three-day Western campaign swing in order to monitor relief operations in a series of meetings at the White House. He met with the head of the Social Security Administration and the postmaster to discuss plans for delivering pension and welfare checks. This morning, the secretaries for Health, Housing, Education, and the Small Business Administration reported on their efforts to speed up the federal response. And Mr. Bush gave a rosy assessment of the situation.
I think real progress is being made, but there's still an awful lot of human suffering there. And what we are all going to try to do is continue to move forward as fast as we can to help alleviate that.
Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said he didn't think President Bush would be hurt politically by the criticisms of the slow federal reaction last week. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
A United Nations spokesman said today that UN workers in Iraq have been placed on maximum alert. The alert was called after an incident on Friday when a bomb was found to be attached to a car used by three UN guards. UN spokesman Francois Giuliani said that the bomb was discovered as the three guards crossed into northern Iraq. The bomb didn't go off and no one was hurt. The bomb is thought to be related to a dispute between the Iraqi government and the UN over the guards sent to protect humanitarian workers in Iraq. Giuliani said that the guards and workers have been put on maximum security. After this morning's session of Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, a Palestinian spokesperson said there was a deadlock. An Israeli spokesperson said, "We feel a certain frustration." Still, both sides express some hope for the talks. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
To break the deadlock, the Palestinians have proposed that the talks now focus on two issues: how to rescind Israeli military orders in the occupied territories, and how to improve human rights treatment for Palestinians there. Spokesperson Hanan Ashrawi said these two topics could be handled by working groups or committees drawn from the Israeli and Palestinian delegations. This begins to sound like an Israeli proposal made some time ago that the delegations form committees to address issues of concern to both sides. However, the Israeli delegation does not want the committees to focus only on the issues of military orders and human rights. Spokesperson Yossi Gal said today, issues like these can be discussed if, in his words, if we discuss the other issues that are the core of the process. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Stock prices fell slightly today on Wall Street after the latest government report showed a drop in new home sales in July. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 10 points to close at 3,257. Advances and declines were about even. This is NPR News. California is still without a budget as the state legislature and the governor narrowed down their dispute over funding for education. Today, the state assembly, the lower house of the legislature, rejected a companion bill that would have made deep cuts in school funding. Over the weekend, both houses passed a $57 billion austerity budget that contained many of the provisions that Governor Pete Wilson has been demanding. The state has now been without a budget for 62 days and has been reduced to issuing almost $3 billion in IOUs to its creditors and employees. White supremacist Randy Weaver surrendered today to federal authorities in northern Idaho. Weaver had barricaded himself and his family in a remote mountain cabin for 11 days following the shooting death of a federal marshal. Lee Garnett of Northwest Public Radio reports.
Weaver Weaver gave up the day after his longtime friend Kevin Harris had surrendered. Harris is accused of murdering Federal Marshal William Deegan. That was the incident that sent hundreds of troops to Weaver's compound. Both men were brought out by former Green Beret Beau Greitz. Greitz took over the negotiations last Friday after he persuaded federal authorities that he remembered Weaver from when both served in the Army's Special Forces. During the 11-day standoff, Weaver's wife and 14-year-old son were killed by gunfire. His three surviving daughters were not hurt when they emerged today. Weaver faces charges of illegal weapon sales and assault on a federal officer. For National Public Radio, this is Lee Garnett reporting.
A new poll shows that the popularity pendulum appears to have swung back to favor Democrat Bill Clinton over the past week. An ABC News Washington Post survey released today shows Clinton with 56% of the vote to 36% for President Bush. That was nearly as big as the lead enjoyed by the Democratic nominee prior to the Republican National Convention. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Susan Sontag is very happy about her new novel. It's gotten rave reviews from many critics, including Fresh Air book critic John Leonard, and it's a bestseller. This level of popular success is unusual for Sontag, who's best known for her intellectually rigorous essays on subjects ranging from photography and contemporary literature to illness as metaphor and the AIDS epidemic. Her new novel, The Volcano Lover, is subtitled A Romance, and it is, in a way, a historical romance, although it doesn't follow the conventions of your average bodice ripper. It's set in 18th century Naples, and it's based on the true story of a love triangle between Sir William Hamilton, the British ambassador to Naples, his wife Emma Hamilton, and Lord Nelson, the British naval hero. A lot of people think it's out of character for Susan Sontag to write about a romance.
It's not that there's a new Susan Sontag that's suddenly revealed. It's so different from the other one. It's that it's been a long journey for me to get to the point where I can write something that includes as much of myself and what I think and what I feel and what interests me as this book does. It has a lot of stuff that I've dealt with in one form or another in fiction or essays or even a play that I wrote 2 years ago, which has been performed in Europe but hasn't yet been performed here. It's just this book is bigger. This book is bigger. It's more alive. It's more direct. It's more ambitious. But the emotional side of it, that was always part of it from the beginning. And I never felt I had to be apologetic about that because that's what we all are. We're full of feeling.
Emma Hamilton was beautiful, although during the course of the story, as you tell it, she becomes more coarse, as she says. I'm wondering, you know, and part of the book is about the attraction of beauty and falling in love with beauty and what beauty means and what we project onto it and so on. And I wonder how attracted you feel to beauty in other people, to physical beauty, how important that's been to you over the years.
I'm very attracted to physical beauty. To me, it is like a virtue in people. It's certainly not the only virtue, and it doesn't. If a person is only beautiful, that's not enough. But to me, it is a great value. And, you know, I think it has something to do with my generation, actually, although I can't say that everybody my generation feels this way. But when I was a child, when I was going to the movies as a child in the 1940s, there were constant images of beauty in the movies. To go to the movies was to see beautiful people, almost impossibly beautiful people. There was no idea, such as we have now, that movie actors should look like real people, and that people who are not outstandingly beautiful can be actors and can, in fact, be the romantic heroines and heroes of stories. I mean, you know what movie stars looked like in the 40s. And I when I think of my own bewitchment to a certain extent by physical beauty, I think of myself as a little girl, you know, going to the movies every Saturday afternoon for that double feature and seeing all these Hollywood stars of the 40s and one, each person more beautiful than the next. And remember, this is before television.
So it's larger than life.
It was larger than life. There was nothing except movies. I just dreamed from one Saturday afternoon to the next about these people.
Has this ever been an obstacle to you in the sense of falling in love with somebody's mind but not their face, and wishing that you could fall in love with their face but not being able to fall in love with that face hold you back from a relationship? Do you know what I mean?
I think falling in love is such a mysterious process. Yeah. You can't even divide it up that way. I mean, I have fallen in love with the most inappropriate people. and I can certainly never say it was the face or the mind. On the whole, I would not say I fall in love with people's minds. I don't think one falls in love with a mind. I think sometimes you can say to yourself, the fact that I have this great mental relationship is enough. But no, I think falling in love is erotic and... Anyway,
but still, as an intellectual who's so involved with the mind, I mean that has to really enter into it a lot, into a relationship, don't you think?
Not necessarily. Uh-huh. I've fallen in love with people who would not be well known for their minds.
Right. Okay.
No, I think I don't know why you fall in love. I don't know. I mean, one doesn't even have to talk about falling in love in an erotic sense. I mean, I have friends who I can't say, I mean, dearly loved friends. These are not romantic relationships. But, you know, friendship can get to be pretty intense and over a long period of time, almost as strong a relationship as an erotic relationship or a family relationship. And I would never say, well, it's the mind of this person that is the greatest attraction. No, I think it's physical, and I think it's character, and character meaning the kind of warmth or exchange or communion or feeling at ease or just joy that you have in another person. And that can include somebody who is not either intellectually distinguished or particularly beautiful. I don't think that's what falling in love is about, or even falling into friendship.
While we're on the subject of physical image, I've got to ask you about this. There's two Annie Leibovitz photos of you that I've seen lately. One was in Vanity Fair, and one is on the book jacket of your new novel, The Volcano Lover. And in both of them, you're in a reclining position. On the book jacket cover, you're, I think, on a couch. It looks like a couch.
And it's actually a very voluptuous chair.
Oh, okay.
which is upholstered, and I'm leaning back. But it's actually a chair. I read in that chair.
And in the Vanity Fair photo, it's a bed?
That's right.
Yeah, so usually a reclining pose indicates a certain kind of, you know, erotic or sensual pose. And I'm wondering if that was intentional on your part or on the photographer's part, and if that had anything to do with the novel being, quote, a romance, as the subtitle says.
Well, maybe it did on the part of the photographer, but I'm, of course, very charmed by the fact that at the age of 59, I can still, without looking ridiculous, pose in a sensuous way. Perhaps I wouldn't have had the courage to do it if the photographer hadn't encouraged me. Yes, of course. Why not? I mean, this is part of my battle on behalf of all women. I remember that wonderful thing that Gloria Steinem said when she turned 50.
Oh, this is what 50 looks like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a remark I think that every single woman took to heart.
Yeah, because people would say, oh, you look so great for 50, and she'd say, this is what 50 looks like.
Yeah, so I want to say this is what 59 looks like.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've said you're not a collector. One of the characters of your books, William Hamilton, is a collector. You've said you're not a collector, but don't you have like 15,000 books?
Yeah, I call that accumulating.
Right.
I'm also somebody who can't throw out letters, and I have even trouble throwing out the New York Times. You know, I always think I read the Times, and I might want to reread some article,
right.
And so they stack up on the kitchen table. No, I'm a pack rat.
Okay, but let me ask you this: in writing about Hamilton, you say perhaps every collector has dreamed of a Holocaust that will relieve him of his collection, converting all to ashes or burying it under lava. Have you ever, in some perverse way, hoped for that with your books?
No, I haven't. I haven't. As a matter of fact, I did have a fire in my apartment that came from a neighboring apartment, and of course, all I could think of was, my God, the books. No, I don't want to be relieved of my books. They're my toys. They're my entertainment. They give me a sense of how big the world is. I mean, many people have said, well, why do you own all these books? I mean, you're not going to... I have read them all, but I'm not rereading them all the time. And I could live a little more economically if I didn't own so many. And when I need a book, after all, there is such thing as a public library. But I actually like having them around. And I sometimes just walk up and down the you know, say the English Literature Wall, and remember all there is there. I like when my sense of the world is stretched, and I realize just by the titles on the spines of my books, you know, what has gone on in the world and how big it is.
When was the fire?
The fire was 6 years ago, and it was a really terrifying experience. I was extremely lucky. I could have lost my life within minutes, actually.
You were in the building when it happened?
I was living in a brownstone in Greenwich Village, and the fire came from a defective chimney in the apartment exactly adjacent to mine in the neighboring building. But as I discovered, because of the fire, there was about 6 inches of brick separating the house I lived in. I rented an apartment on the top floor from this neighboring building, and it had spread to the roof of the neighboring building, and then to the roof of the building in which I lived. And I woke up at 7 in the morning, and my eyes were closed, obviously, and I came to consciousness, and I thought to myself, there are 100 mice running around the ceiling, which, of course, was the kind of thought you have as you come out of sleep, and that doesn't make any sense at all. And I opened my eyes, and the ceiling was on fire.
Wow.
And if I hadn't awakened, I obviously would have died. And I got out of a burning room and ran downstairs. But I was very, very lucky, because there was, as I ran into the street in my bathrobe, the fire engine was pulling up, because there was a tall building nearby, and they'd seen the fire, and they'd already called the fire department.
I've several times been in a crowd of people looking at a building that was burning down. What was it like to be the person whose home that is?
Well, as I stood on the street and the firemen charged up the stairs, I just assumed they would, you know, the fire would spread, they would use their hoses, the apartment would be wrecked, and that was it. And I stood there and I thought, this is really extraordinary. I'm losing all my letters. I'm losing all my manuscripts. I'm losing all my photographs. You know, my photographs of my son as a child, and myself and my sister, and the past, all the books. That was what I thought of. It's funny. I thought of the things on paper. So I didn't care about the clothes, and I didn't care about the furniture, obviously, which was absolutely nothing.
So did you lose all that, or did
no? I just lost the bedroom, what was in the bedroom, mm-hmm. and part of the closet. It wasn't bad, but of course the apartment was absolutely trashed by the firemen. But they were wonderful too. I was very, very, very lucky.
Right. Susan Sontag is my guest. If you're just joining us, she has a new novel. It's called The Volcano Lover. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Susan Sontag is my guest. One of the things that's changed recently in your life is money. You've always made a living as a writer and not as an academic. You've never been a full-time teacher.
Not at all. When I was very young, in my 20s, I did go to graduate school. I expected to teach. I taught for a few years while I was ostensibly writing my PhD. And then when I decided to write my first book, in my late 20s, when I thought I was ready to do that, which was a novel, The Benefactor, I resigned from my teaching position, and I've never taught since. Mm. I really feel teaching, it's not that I don't love teaching, but I think it's a full-time job. I don't want to be a writer who writes on weekends and vacations.
Well, that for many years kept your income pretty low.
Very low.
In fact, when you had breast cancer, and we spoke about this once before, you didn't even have health insurance because...
That's a definition of an artist, isn't it?
Right, so right. Well,
I didn't have any institutional affiliation. I'd always been a very healthy person, and of course that was not a very practical thing to do. Yeah, my life has changed because...
Well, you have a good advance. You got a very good advance for your new book, and you got a MacArthur Award, too, which is giving you, I think, $350,000 over 4 years, which is...
Five years,
which is wonderful.
$340,000
over
5 years.
I'm sorry,
God. Well, it makes a little difference.
Yeah.
No, it's tremendous.
So how is it affecting your life?
I don't sweat at the end of every month thinking how I'm going to pay the bills. It doesn't change anything. It just... I wouldn't do anything any differently, in the sense I wouldn't write anything any different, whether I had no money or some money. It means I don't have this enormous anxiety, and it means that I now have an apartment, which I've had for a year and a half, where I can put all my books up instead of a lot of them being in storage. It doesn't change anything.
Does it give you more of a feeling of security?
Well, no, it isn't a positive feeling. It's more the absence of negative feelings. I don't want to be secure. I just, it's nice not to be extremely uncomfortable. It's nice not to have to think about whether I can afford to go to a restaurant or pick up a check in a restaurant. It's nice to be able to give money away, because I think money should be shared. If you have more than a friend, I think you should, and the friend is in need, you should give the friend money.
And a lot of friends did that for you, I should say, when you were sick.
Sure. So, but it doesn't change anything. I'm really not interested in security. In fact, if I felt I were secure, I probably would want to change that to make myself insecure.
Mm-hmm.
I want to feel a little bit on the edge, and that's something that I've heard that as you get older, you care more about security. But I haven't experienced that at all. I don't care about it. In fact, if anything. I don't want to feel too settled.
Yeah.
I just do like having an apartment big enough to put all my books on the walls.
Right. You wrote a book a few years ago called Illness as Metaphor, in which you wrote, this was during the period that you had cancer, and you wrote about the things that people project onto people with cancer and how that compared to what had been projected in the past, for instance, on people who had tuberculosis. And if I'm remembering correctly, because it's been several years since I read the book, one of the things that you said is that tuberculosis, people would project a certain kind of spirituality onto people who had that disease as they withered away.
As if they were becoming more refined.
Yes, yeah.
It was thought to be the cliche in literature and art and opera, was that it was a romantic disease, of course.
Well, it's coming back now, and I'm wondering what you're observing with the revival of the TB epidemic, since you'd written about the projections.
I don't think anybody is going to project this on the current tuberculosis epidemic. I mean, it seems as if in every period there is a disease that has a romantic stereotype and a disease which is demonized and which is felt to be a curse. And it distributed itself in a certain way in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And now everything has changed. Everything has changed above all because of AIDS. In fact, a lot of the phobia about cancer and the demonization of cancer has been reduced in part because there is a new a disease which is identical to having a stigma. And which is moralized over, and that's the various illness situations that we call AIDS.
No, I didn't realize, I think when I read the book, unless I'd just forgotten this, that your father died of tuberculosis.
That's right.
When you were 5 years old. How did that affect your view of illness?
Well, I don't think at 5 years old you're thinking about the illness, you're just thinking about this person who's never going to come back. Because my father lived abroad, and I expected him to be returning on a trip, on a visit, and then he didn't come, and then only many months later was I told that he had died. So, I'm sure no one who has that kind of wound early in life is unaffected by it. Maybe in some way that I wasn't even aware of when I made the comparison of tuberculosis and cancer. My father died of tuberculosis. I had cancer. There was a resonance, an echo. I certainly wasn't consciously aware of it. But yes, one tries to come to terms with it. But interestingly enough, about the stereotypes about concerning these illnesses, I was not told that my father died of tuberculosis by my mother. I was told that he died of pneumonia. And it was only when I was about 10 years old and on a visit to the family doctor, and being a curious person as I was then and still am, looked at my records when the doctor stepped out of the room and left them on his desk. I guess he didn't think I would look. I was only 10 years old, and I read my and I saw father deceased TB. And then I asked my mother, who had taken me to the doctor on the way home, what does TB mean? And for some reason, I didn't know what it meant. I think since I knew that he was supposed to have died of tuberculosis, I had quickly invented something in my mind. This was pneumonia type B. You know, it's complete invention. And right. she looked quite embarrassed, and I remember the moment very well when she said, well, actually, your father died of tuberculosis. And I was stunned, and I said, well, why did you tell me pneumonia? And she said, and I remember it very well, she said, well, many people feel that that tuberculosis is communicable, and I didn't want you to be feel worried about whether you might get it or be there. In other words, she communicated to me in a not very articulate way that there was some kind of stigma about tuberculosis. It was very vague, but that there was something a little bit shameful or something that should be concealed. And she was reflecting attitudes which were, you know, which were really the attitudes of the past, of the earlier part of this century and the 19th century, that there was something shameful about tuberculosis as well as glamorous or romantic or spiritualizing. So I did hear as a child the tail end of that cycle of attitudes, and it must have been somewhere in my mind, although not consciously,
yeah.
When I was inspired to make that comparison between attitudes toward tuberculosis and attitudes toward cancer, which is part of the argument of illness as metaphor.
I have one last question for you, and this is about getting a literary agent. This book is the first book for which you had a literary agent. Why did you get an agent this time around? Or what I should be asking is, how come you never had one before, since most writers have an agent not only to... I mean, you've been at the same publisher for Ostrash Giroux for your whole career, and they're, you know, they're...
And they're great.
Yeah, right. They're a very esteemed publisher. But still, it's hard to, like, negotiate the financial end of things yourself, you know, when you're... A lot of people really prefer having that financial relationship dealt with by an agent so that they can have a relationship with their editor and with their publishing company that isn't about money.
Well, I guess I was not having an agent was my idea about being pure. I wanted not to do things in a normal way, and I wanted to be better, and I thought that it wasn't important, and it would just all take care of itself. And anyway, I love my publishing house, and I think they're wonderful, and I couldn't imagine leaving them. And so it just seemed that it was okay, whatever worked out, and I didn't have to pay any attention to it. And maybe as I guess. As this book proves, I'm a rather late developer. You see, I'm very slow. So I finally figured out very belatedly that I should have an agent about 30 years later than perhaps I should have. And I'm just slow, as I say. I've written my best book after all these years, so I just finally figured out that I should have an agent. It doesn't change anything, but it was a good idea.
Did your agent ask for things that you wouldn't have dreamed of asking for yourself?
Of course. That's what agents are for. Of course. He asked for more money. Absolutely. I would never have dreamed of asking for that much money. And that's what agents are for. And as I say, it took me a long time to figure that out. When everybody else found that perfectly obvious, and I was very proud of not having an agent. I mean, it was a bit of a conscientious but utterly sincere naivete on my part. I don't regret it. I don't regret having been so naive in the past, but... You know, it was time when it happened.
It feels good to have a good deal.
Sure. Now I can have an apartment where I can put up all my books.
Right. Well, Susan Sontag, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Susan Sontag's new novel, The Volcano Lover, A Romance, is published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the selling of access and influence in Washington. Susan Trento is the author of a new book about how public relations and lobbying are distorting American politics. We'll find out what happened when a big PR company took on Kuwait as a client just before the Gulf War. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings of Beethoven sonatas performed by Andrew Rangel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Workers in Miami went back to their jobs today, trying to resume normal schedules 1 week after Hurricane Andrew devastated southern Dade County. Rick Stone of member station WUSF reports.
The city itself is largely intact, although most of the stoplights don't work, and traffic is still being controlled by civilian volunteers at intersections. Metro Rail and much of the bus service have resumed as the work week begins. But for drivers, commuting times are expected to double and triple. In Homestead, south of here, the first of the 10 cities is under construction at a city park, and 1,500 are expected to take shelter there tonight. Although 250,000 were rendered homeless by Hurricane Andrew, emergency managers said today most of those have insurance or other resources, and preparations were being made to deal with the 20,000 or so who don't. Also today, Governor Lawton Chiles said the frustration level in Dade County appears to be easing. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
President Bush says he will return to Florida and Louisiana tomorrow to check on hurricane relief efforts. The president called insurance agency executives and other officials connected with the cleanup to the White House today. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Mr. Bush wanted to hear from insurance companies how they will handle the flood of claims. The president also asked the heads of the Postal Service and Social Security Administration how retirees in South Florida will get their benefit checks if they can't get mail at their home addresses. Fitzwater said trucks with loudspeakers are being used to tell people where to go to get their mail. Among the other people the president talked with were officials of several building trades and humanitarian groups. The Bush campaign ridiculed rival Bill Clinton today for running on his record as governor of Arkansas. Clinton's new television ad lists the successes of his six terms. The Bush campaign intends to stress the failures. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Bush campaign welcomed Clinton's first general election ad with open arms today. Senior Bush campaign strategist Robert Teeter said if Clinton wants to run on his record as governor, the Bush campaign will help.
Governor Clinton's record is one of taking a state when he became governor in the late 1970s with some very difficult problems and leading it nowhere.
Teeter says Arkansas had slower job and income growth during the 1980s than the rest of the nation. Clinton fired back today from Little Rock, saying that the Bush administration has no credibility to say anything about jobs. Although Mr. Bush has yet to campaign on his specific economic record of the last 3.5 years, Teeter told reporters today that the economy is the dominant issue of the campaign. Teeter said the president will continue to stress his economic proposals that were blocked by Congress. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 10 points today in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Chances for an end to California's 2-month budget impasse appear to be fading as lawmakers continue to battle with Governor Pete Wilson over education spending. Steve Scott reports from Sacramento.
A weekend of hope that the 9-week budget deadlock may be ending ran into a brick wall in the state assembly on this, the last scheduled day of the legislative session. The assembly is considering a bill that would cut roughly $1 billion from schools this year, but prevent reductions in school spending in future years. Governor Pete Wilson says such a deal is not acceptable and would force him to veto the budget.
It will not be a balanced budget if, in fact, there are gaping holes in it.
The dispute must be resolved by midnight, or thousands of state workers will go without paychecks, and care centers for the disabled may be closed. California has been without a budget since July 1st and has issued more than $3 billion in IOUs. For National Public Radio, this is Steve Scott in Sacramento.
Public school teachers in Detroit have voted overwhelmingly to strike. They are seeking a pay increase of 6%. Today, they turned down a proposal that would have given them a 3% bonus if they attended workshops without pay. The teachers had been scheduled to report for work today, a day before classes were to have begun. Contract negotiations are expected to resume tomorrow. Detroit is the nation's seventh largest school district. A federal appeals court has ruled that the Red Cross must disclose information about a blood donor who may have been infected with HIV. The court today rejected Red Cross arguments that a safe and adequate supply of donated blood would be jeopardized if potential donors feared becoming involved in a lawsuit. The ruling came in a wrongful death suit filed by Cynthia Watson against the Red Cross and the Medical University of South Carolina. Her infant son died of AIDS after a blood transfusion. The court ruled she can get medical information, but not the donor's name. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Susan Trento describes her new book as an investigation into what Washington has become. More specifically, she's looking at the selling of access and influence in Washington. Her new book, The Powerhouse, focuses on Robert Keith Gray, who just stepped down last week as head of the Washington office of Hill & Knowlton, a powerful PR company with a controversial roster of clients. She says Gray wrote the book on international public relations. His company's clients have included the Communist Government of Angola, the BCCI, the Reverend Sun Myung-moon, and China after Tiananmen Square. Gray has had close connections with Presidents Reagan and Bush. In 1980, he co-chaired Reagan's inaugural committee. Trento says PR experts like Gray use their political connections to lure clients. Just before the Gulf War, Hill & Knowlton took on Kuwait as a client and promoted the group Citizens for a Free Kuwait. I asked Trento what the company did for Kuwait.
It was a massive campaign. A large public relations account might be $1 million a year. The government of Kuwait funneled in over $10 million in just a few months. So it was an enormous amount of money, and a large effort was made to try to encourage the American public to support war against Iraq. They did it by taking a poll to find out what the American people believed, what would make them angry enough, what were the buttons to push to make them really want to fight Saddam Hussein, and it was atrocities. So they provided video press releases, radio shows, congressional hearings, and they would produce as many atrocities as they could, some of them legitimate. Obviously, there were atrocities, but others were later questioned as being manufactured.
Was Citizens for a Free Kuwait formed or named by the public relations company that represented it?
Right. That was the name made up by Hill & Knowlton. And actually, if you look at the registration forms, the first name was Committee for a Free Kuwait, but I guess that didn't sound as good as Citizens.
So what was the difference between what that group appeared to be and what it actually was?
Well, it appeared to be, this spontaneous group of citizens who were coming forward to try to in support of Kuwait, to try to encourage the American public to support those issues. You know, in reality, it was a very well-financed campaign paid for by the government of Kuwait that, in effect, drowns out our debate that we should have in this country when we're facing something like war, so that instead of having like spontaneous demonstrations for peace or for war or whatever, you know, you had these very well orchestrated campaigns where people would be told when and where to show up, and they would all have on color-coordinated T-shirts and balloons, and it was paid for and organized and staged events that weren't really real.
How do you think Citizens for a Free Kuwait misled the American public?
Well, you know, in the case of Naira, who, you know, was first 2020 and 60 Minutes and others have reported on this before, but Naira was a 15-year-old teary-eyed girl that Helen Knowlton put before a committee on Capitol Hill that was holding hearings at the time. It was a human rights committee holding hearings at the time before the war. And she testified. It was stated that she had just fled from Kuwait, that she could, that they could not identify who she was for fear of her family in Kuwait. And she testified very movingly that she had witnessed hundreds of babies being ripped from their incubators so that the Iraqis could take the incubators back to Baghdad, and these babies were left on the floor to die. It was very moving. It was very emotional, and horrifying, you know, obviously. Even Amnesty International believed it, and the president himself made references to this atrocity. After the war, when reporters went into Kuwait to try to verify this story, they were unable to do so. The human rights groups were unable to do so, and that led many to question whether it was accurate or not. Later, it was also revealed that she was the ambassador from Kuwait's daughter, and some even questioned whether she was even there at the time.
You write that one of the innovations of this company was really bragging about who your clients were. That before Robert Gray, that the Washington PR and lobbying groups were very kind of circumspect about who their clients were. But when Robert Gray came along, there was a lot of kind of bragging about who clients were. And what went along with that?
Well, you know, in the old days, especially, lobbyists sort of worked behind the scenes and would only brag about their accomplishments behind closed doors. It was something that they wouldn't do openly, mainly because, you know, it would be embarrassing to the politicians who were involved to, you know, have a lobbyist saying they had manipulated them or co-opted them in any way. When Robert Gray sort of hit the scene with his own company in the 1980s, attitudes had changed. You know, Reagan had come in, and in a lot of ways, everything was the wealth and the Cadillacs and the chauffeurs and those sorts of things were brought back into the streets, and Gray started promoting himself and his clients as, you know, the top PR firm in Washington, and sort of making lobbying, he was a big push to make lobbying and public relations more of a respected profession, something that was a goal to attain in itself. You know, it was a whole change in attitude that he in a way pioneered. He would make speeches about, you know, how lobbying was respectable nowadays, and it was no longer the booze and broads and bribes that it used to be in the old days. But, you know, his own staff used to laugh at me and say, you know, Susan, that's not true. They can call them PACs and Paramours and Perrier nowadays, but in many ways they operate the same way. I think the self-promotion reached its peak in the mid-80s when Michael Deaver, who had just left the White House to start his own public relations and lobbying firm, was featured on the cover of Time magazine in a limo talking on the phone. After that, there was so much criticism about just blatant influence peddling in Washington that it started to, the publicity, the self-seeking publicity started to decline a little bit.
My guest is Susan Trento, author of the new book, The Powerhouse. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Susan Trento, author of the new book, The Powerhouse, Robert Keith Gray and the Selling of Access and Influence in Washington. Your book is about influence peddling. Let me ask you to explain what influence peddling is and how you think influence peddling has escalated in Washington?
Well, in the old days, lobbyists justified their existence by saying that their role was to provide information that wasn't really available to anybody but them, because they represented the corn industry or the banking industry, or, you know, you could just name anything. They were the experts, and so they would go to Congress and provide them with information. That was the so-called good lobbyist. You know, technology and governments changed so much, especially starting in the 1970s, where the need for that sort of information no longer exists. Congress has enormous staffs. They've set up, you know, the General Accounting Office, the Library of Congress, the Office of Technology Assistance. They have available to them whatever information they need without having to go through a lobbyist to receive that. So nowadays what you see more and more of are people who just trade on their access and friendships, people who do not have any expertise, any educational business backgrounds in the areas that they are representing. That what they're selling is their friendship and access to people that they've gained by, you know, doing them favors, contributing to them, befriending them, and are working with them and turning around and then lobbying them. That's what influence peddling is, and that's what's going on more and more in Washington today.
I guess this is where the revolving door comes in, where people who were high-placed in government end up becoming lobbyists or public relations experts with the idea that they know the people in power.
Right. And, you know, even in the, you know, there's been a lot of talk about and a lot of coverage, and especially I think South Carolina and Arizona, on, you know, lobbying corruption at the state capitol. But even in the state capitals, you don't even see the sort of revolving door that you do in Washington.
In examples where people who were high-placed in a presidential administration became lobbyists or public relations experts, how effective do you think they've been in influencing government in their role in public relations or lobbying because of their former relationships with those people in power?
Well,
how well does this actually work in practice?
Well, in practice, it works well as far as obtaining access. You know, it's basically human nature. You know, if you've got 400 phone calls to return, you call first the people you know, the people you're familiar with. You know, maybe you'll call your friends, that sort of thing. You know, one lobbyist told me, hey, they don't just throw their phone messages in the air and, you know, grab whichever ones fall on their desk to return their calls.
What do you think the price of the new kind of lobbyist and public relations expert, what do you think the price is for the American public?
I think the biggest problem is that the average American doesn't have the resources to buy into the system. You know, they can't afford to pay somebody $400 or $500 an hour. And in a democracy, you know, that is, it's our government. It's not who you can pay for. You know, one lobbyist told me he compared Washington like a casino, say, like in Atlantic City, and said, well, you know, of course, only the high rollers get all the attention, and the American public, the average American, was just the nickel slot person, you know, that they sort of put off to the side. Then he sat back in his chair, and he laughed, and he said, but, you know, it's true, isn't it? You know, somebody only making $40,000 a year doesn't really have much at stake anyway.
One of the real paradoxes in your book is when the company that you write about takes on communist Angola as a client. And so here's a capitalist company taking on a communist country because they're going to make money.
Right.
It's quite a paradox.
It is. It is, and it was also, at the time, very controversial because the firm had been so closely aligned with the Reagan administration, who had been so vocally opposed to the communist government in Angola and was supporting, you know, UNITA and the opposition parties.
Have prices escalated now that we have these, like, super lobbyists and super PR companies?
It's a lot of money being made. You know, the accounts have gone from, like, maybe $15,000 a year to $50,000 just for retainer, and then you bill above that. You bill, you know, your hours, the secretary's hours, just like a law firm would, you know, whether they Xerox something for you. Newsweek had an article in last January that said having lunch with Robert Gray might cost you $1,000 with all the expenses of the limousine, the secretaries, you know, and everything by the hour.
Susan Trento is the author of the new book, The Powerhouse. Here's a footnote to our interview. In a footnote in her book, Trento writes about the alleged affair between George Bush and Jennifer Fitzgerald. Trento quotes a 1986 interview with Louis Fields, the late ambassador to the disarmament talks in Geneva. He said it became clear to him that Bush and Fitzgerald were romantically involved when Fields had to make arrangements for Bush and Fitzgerald to stay in adjoining rooms in a guest house in Switzerland. The footnote made news and got much more attention than Trento's book did. I asked her how she felt about that.
I have mixed feelings because, you know, I didn't want my book to get lost in a controversy like this that was really sort of insignificant to my book. But I'm not critical of the reporters who followed up and done things on it because, you know, I think family values and those sorts of things have been made an issue, and that everything regarding the president and or the Democratic candidate have to be pursued.
Journalist Susan Trento. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from South Florida?
Florida goes back to work today, Terry. A lot of people who have been staying home trying to take care of what went on with the hurricane are now trying to get back to their jobs. We'll report on how that happened. We'll take a look at some potential health problems in Florida. And Andre Codrescu will share with us what he did the day before, Andrew. We'll also have a report on lead poisoning, which is far more serious and commonplace than most people realize. A report on third world migrations into Europe from Africa, particularly in the Middle East, and 25 great guitar solos.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Toward the end of Beethoven's life, he began to break away from the traditional forms of classical music that he himself helped to develop. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says that Beethoven's profound last works, especially his chamber music and piano sonatas, are also among the strangest pieces of music ever written. Lloyd has a review of a recent recording of Beethoven's last five sonatas by pianist Andrew Rangel that he says really comes to grips with both Beethoven's profundity and his strangeness.
I think genius by definition implies not only greatness but eccentricity, the need to fly out from what has become established as the center. Beethoven was a genius in just this way, and pianist Andrew Rangel is a genius in the same way. For the past few years, he's been performing the complete cycle of 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. He's just recorded the last five, and they hardly ever sound the way you expect them to. Parts are almost unrecognizable, shocking. They're full of dazzling off-center balances, continual surprises in pacing, rhythm, and tone. Rangel sounds as if Beethoven were improvising. We don't hear calculated formal structures, but changing emotions, evolving, unfolding with a new kind of inevitability.
Thank you.
Rangel isn't just willful. He has a carefully thought-out view of Beethoven and his piano sonatas in particular. Beethoven himself described his earlier Moonlight Sonata as quasi-fantasia, like a fantasy. Beethoven himself never mentioned anything about moonlight. Rangel suggests that all these late works seem more like fantasies than traditional sonatas. In his liner notes, he writes that in a lifetime of endowing the unpredictable and even the fantastic with an inner logic truer than the at-hand variety, Beethoven in the last sonatas surely approached his own ideals of formal mastery, of unfettered expression, and of genuine fantasy. And the kind of freedom that Rangel permits himself gives these Beethoven sonatas a rare emotional directness. Under Rangel's fingertips, form seems to become feeling. He can sustain some extremely slow tempos in the slow movements because each moment is a revelation. Rangel calls it Beethoven's slow unburdening. Everything leads somewhere, and the effect is cumulative. Listening to the sonatas in order, I was struck by how much each one sounded as if it were part of a larger, devastating whole. I think that's just what Rangel, and maybe Beethoven himself, had in mind.
Music critic Lloyd Schwartz. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Lynn Yeko. She's never run for elected office before, but this year she's running against the Republican incumbent Arlen Specter for the Pennsylvania Senate seat. She says Specter's interrogation of Anita Hill inspired Yackel to try to defeat him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.